this week, gold held its ground on dollar weakness while the equities bull reached yet another record close. Hello, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, back with you for another edutainment-packed program. Well, we have a guest triple header this weekend. Fabian Calvo manages a $100 million portfolio of distressed properties. His industry contacts insist that a new housing bubble is gaining momentum thanks to easy credit once again, and insiders could soon dump those overpriced McMansions on the public, resulting in an even worse panic than 2008. That could send the bond market and the U.S. dollar sharply lower, sending lots of investment money directly into your favorite investment sector, gold and silver. Next, veteran quantitative investor Charles Nenner of the Charles Nenner Research Center uses the skills he honed as a trader at Goldman Sachs to search for cycles in market data. He's long gold with one eye on the U.S. dollar. And then Frank Holmes uses his proprietary statistical methods to forecast the markets and says the odds favor a big bullish move this year for gold, silver, and related equities as the sector returns to the mean, bouncing sharply from oversold conditions. And be sure to listen to Robert Ian's latest report as he wraps up this week's show. Gold Seek Radio begins now with a market weather report. Mostly sunny weather was seen over the precious metals market this week on QE positive comments from the new Fed, Dr. Janet Yellen. Investors viewed somewhat dovish comments to indicate QE stimulus could continue in 2014. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold added about $2, finishing at $13.28, but silver dropped about 40 cents, ending near $21.23 an ounce. In January, demand, though, for silver coins sold by the U.S. Mint almost quadrupled. One source claims that silver mine production has been disrupted over the last 6 months due to low silver prices below the cost of mining, making some mines close up operations altogether. Some analysts have pegged the cost of mining around $20 an ounce. Meanwhile, platinum added about $17, finishing at $14.46 an ounce, and palladium gained about $4, closing near $7.43 an ounce. The chart on palladium, by the way, is very bullish. West Texas Intermediate crude added about half a dollar, finishing at $102.76 per barrel, the highest price in almost 4 months. Meanwhile, reports indicate that the London gold fix may soon be, well, broken. The gold fix is a standard used by industry insiders and central banks to value the price of gold. But according to sources, the benchmark has been manipulated for at least a decade by the banks setting the number. Abnormal trading patterns apparently occur around 3 p.m. London time, when a private conference call between the five biggest gold dealers set the price. The rate has been set for a century now. Currently, Barclays, Deutsche Bank, Bank of Nova Scotia, HSBC, and Societe Generale are suspected of manipulating the $20 trillion gold market. The rate setting began apparently in 1919, though, with the Rothschild business operations. But the world's wealthiest family wisely exited that profitable business around the gold market nadir that we saw at the turn of this century. Today, the fix is calculated twice a day on the telephone through conferences at around 10:30 a.m. and again at 3 p.m. London time. The calls usually last about 10 minutes, according to the source, and they can run for as long as an hour. The five firms announce the number of bars they wish to buy or sell at the current prices based on orders from their clients and within the firms. The process is unregulated, and five banks can trade gold and their derivatives throughout the call. Researchers who examined the price fix claim that in 2010, large moves during the fix were negative 92% of the time. Deutsche Bank did agree, however, to withdraw from these panels, ending their operations. Elsewhere, Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen told the Senate Banking Committee this week that the softness in data in the U.S. economy should help keep the Fed on track to keep their benchmark interest rate low, at least as long as unemployment remains above 6.5% and inflation does not exceed 2.5%. The recovery in the U.S. labor market is far from complete, she said. Although the comments were viewed as gold positive, the Fed head did mention that the reductions will continue, or tapering, if you will, in measured steps. Moving on, in geopolitical news, violent clashes continued in Ukraine as the Crimea Regional Parliament raised the Russian flag. Lawmakers in the capital will meet to approve a new cabinet. Heightened tensions with one of the world's leading militaries increased safe haven demand. On a more positive note, UBS AG noted this week that gold has started to shed its negative stigma. They've increased their 2014 price forecast to $1,300. That's a $100 boost. Another leading investment bank, Crédit Agricole's private banking unit, said that the easy money from being net short is probably behind us, suggesting that it's time to cover shorts and go long. They cited robust gold demand from China. Today, UBS said in a report that U.S. clients are becoming friendlier to gold investing, and the price may trade in a new range above $1,300. Citigroup said that there is a solid chance that gold has bottomed for this cycle. Moving on, assets in Spider's Gold Trust, the biggest ETF in the sector, will record the largest monthly increase in nearly a year and a half. Holdings climbed for 3 weeks running, the longest streak since August. Holdings climbed to 801 tons, the first increase in 14 months, according to a report from Bloomberg News. So what does the smart money think of the precious metals sector? Well, John Paulson, the biggest owner of the largest gold ETF, left his shares unchanged in the fourth quarter, according to the latest U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission's filing. The 10 million shares are valued at about $1.2 billion. Paulson & Company manages about $21 billion altogether, so they have roughly about 5% invested in gold. He also maintained his stake in Agnico Eagle Mines. That was a favorite, AEM, of our late and dear friend Bob Chapman. He also cut his stake, though, in his Anglo Ashanti Limited's American Depository Receipts. And as predicted in the recent show by yours truly, George Soros did indeed accumulate precious metals. The Soros Fund Management acquired 6.3 million shares of Barrick Gold in the fourth quarter. Bottom line on the precious metals. Well, a top industry analyst is calling for a huge run in silver this year, with prices heading north of 30 by the fall and possibly even a spike to 40 with a low probability. He's calling for triple-digit gold, $100 and more, within just 2 years due to record physical demand. Plus, Barrick's CEO, Jamie Sokalsky, said he is more optimistic that prices have bottomed amid reports of Chinese demand and slowing ETF sales. The U.S. dollar broke down below key support levels this week as predicted in the last report. If the decline gains momentum, it could be just what's needed to send the precious metals soaring. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, mostly sunny skies were seen over the New York Stock Exchange this week on QE positive comments from the new Fed chairwoman. For the week, the Dow added 218 points, ending at 16,321. The S&P 500 dropped 23 points, finishing at 1859, while the NASDAQ bucked the trend, closing at yet another 15-year high point, picking up about 1%, about 44 points, and ending the week at 4308. Better-than-expected economic reports helped push the markets to new highs this week. The U.S. economy expanded at a 2.4% annual pace in the fourth quarter, plus business activity improved according to the Chicago Purchasing Managers Index. Consumer sentiment rose, viewed by some as the backbone of the GDP and national economy. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, you know, greed continues to enter investors' psyche here, as viewed by the 7-component fear index. But we still haven't reached such a high level that the markets would appear to be completely oversold. For next week's forecasts, all the stock picks and related information, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Coming up, more GoldSeek.com radio with Frank Holmes, Fabian Calvo, and Charles Nenner. We want you to stay with us here at GoldSeek. The CEO and Chief Investment Officer of U.S. Global Investors, Mr. Frank Holmes, makes his debut appearance on GoldSeek.com radio. His firm manages mutual funds and hedge funds focusing on gold, natural resources, and emerging markets. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Let's begin with one of your recent articles. You share an interesting fact regarding the gold shares, that high volatility we apparently have to endure as we have now over the past 2 or 3 years actually can work for us. It can be a positive, as it tends to wash out some of the weaker hands very quickly. You show that in the last 3 decades, the XAU has never recorded a string of losses that lasted more than 3 years.
Yeah, it's quite rare. And the other thing that's rare is that we like to look at statistics that try to measure volatility is very different than risk. Company can have risk because of financial covenants or et cetera, but what is the DNA of volatility of different asset classes? And what we've seen is that the DNA of volatility for gold, bullion, over any rolling 12 months, it can go plus or minus 15%, and this occurs 70% of the time. Now, if it falls 30%, buy, because this is very rare, and then there's a 90% probability of bouncing at least 15% or going back to the mean. If it jumps 30% over any 12-month period, that means take profits, because mathematically it says over 30 years of data points, the odds of reverting to the mean are extremely high. And when gold hit $1,900, it was up 2 standard deviations over 12 months, and it went through as a huge correction. Now, gold and gold stocks have 2 different DNAs of volatility. Gold stocks are 3 times that number. So you're talking about close to 40% DNA of volatility. So any time, that means 70% of the time, gold stocks can rise 40% or fall 40% over 12 months. Anytime it falls more than that, then you have the probability of a rise. And this is just a 12-month rolling. Now we take a look at decades and we look at other snapshots. And what's rare is that gold has only had 1 down period in the past 12 years, bullion, but the gold stocks have taken it on the chin for 3 years. And what we try to do is put that in context over the past 30 years of data. How often has that happened? And it's happened 2 other times in addition to the recent 3rd time. So odds favor of a big rally, especially because gold and gold stocks are down of a big magnitude last year.
The incredible rebound that followed the previous 3-year decline, you also point out this rebound period. You show that the XAU rallied 85% in 1993. You know, U.S. Global Investors Precious Metals Fund, you show, climbed 124% during the same period.
Well, what's important there is countries. And back at that time period, South Africa was a major gold producer. And the rand had gone under a huge decline. So they were able to receive, on a revenue side, huge increase because gold rallies 30%. Therefore, they were able to generate much more revenue. But they're paying in South African rand that went basically from, I think, 7 to 1 to 15 to 1. So their cost structure halved. But the price went up 30%, so the profit margins of free cash flow to South Africa were the biggest in the world. And those stocks, as a whole, went up 120%, and we had shifted a lot of our gold producers into South Africa. Then the following year, the rand went through a huge rally, and we shifted into Canadian companies in Latin America because the pesos of Latin America were under great pressure, but the price of gold had risen. So you had expanding profit margins.
You direct investors to keep an eye on government policies, that the Bank of England was at least somewhat responsible for that 3-year sell-off that culminated in that 2000 to 2001 lows in the gold market. They auctioned off much of the UK's gold reserves, about 400 tons, amounting to $3.5 billion at the time. And of course, you show that would have risen to about $15 billion plus today, about a 400% opportunity cost. Could you tell us then what government actions and policies are you keeping an eye on?
Well, one of the key parts when you hear the fear trade, which dominates most of the psychic of North American gold investors, is about 40% of the demand. The other 60% is the love trade. So it's so important to follow what's taking place in Asia and the Middle East. That's one reason why gold went to 1900, is because back in the 70s, China, affectionately known as Chindia, had no global economic footprint. So they've gone from 2% of the global GDP to over 24% of the global GDP, and they're 40% of the world's population. So as they've grown in their GDP per capita, the consumption of gold has increased all through Southeast Asia, Middle East, etc. So that's an important factor here. Now when we look at this fear trade, which dominates most of our psychic here, one has to look at government policies, not the political party, is what we quite often advocate. And one of the things that took place last year that was a headwind for gold was that at this time last year, on a five-year government, U.S. government bond, you were losing money. If you went and bought one of those bonds, you locked in a loss based on the inflationary rate for the next 5 years. When the government said the Federal Reserve were going to pull away the punch bowl of quantitative easing number three, then all of a sudden interest rates for 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, mortgages, all spiked. And with that, we had the CPI number go from over 2% down to 1.5%. So we had a negative real interest rate that by December went to positive. And any time you can get a positive rate of return on a government bond, then gold starts to become less attractive as a fear in that country's currency. So we look at all these major countries' currencies and look at real interest rates as the determining factor. So what we believe now we're going to see going forward is CPI is going to start to rise. There's lots of capacity utilization opportunities, so there's lots of still slack in the economic engine, and therefore rates are not going to spike up rapidly. We've seen rates actually come down for 10-year, 5-year, and mortgages have come down over the past 3 months. So we feel that we're going to have this compression, and gold is showing that. Gold has had a big pop. In one of my recent investor alerts, I commented that one of the things to look at monetary policy is besides interest rates, is money supply. Money supply is a very important factor in addition to real interest rates. And what we've seen in the G7 countries, and includes America, is that money supply has been growing at less than a 5% annualized rate. Sometimes 3%, America in that range. And all of a sudden in January, we saw an annualized rate spike to over 8%. Well, that is usually a reflection of lots of money velocity picking up, lots of loans being made, etc. And that's usually a precursor to inflation. And gold immediately starts to respond to that. So those two factors that all gold investors that are focused on the fear trade should be looking at is what are real interest rates on five-year government bonds and what is the growth in the money supply.
Two other indicators that you watch closely, the ETF inflows, and you've noted that these gold ETFs, such as the Street Tracks and others, you also note that the COMEX gold stockpile is running out of physical yellow metal, and you think that this could lead to a surge in demand. Please tell us more.
Well, I think what we're witnessing is that our time horizon, most hedge funds is 30 days. Most mutual fund investors are 1 year, 3 years max. So you'll see that 3 years seems to be the key factor, and there was huge redemptions in the gold funds because they were down for 3 years. And I think it's important to take a look at the Chinese have a different horizon. And what we're witnessing is that renminbi last year was strong. They have the largest U.S. foreign reserves, and they've been slowly rolling that into gold. They've been they're the largest gold producer in the world. They absorb all their own gold supply. And two, they're also importing the greatest amount of gold as they're building their reserves. So converting a strong currency and converting some of their U.S. reserves, et cetera, into gold at a cheaper and cheaper price, that a hedge fund wouldn't do this because they have to go mark to market every month. They have a very short time horizon. China doesn't. China is going to build this up over time. It takes 5 years to accumulate where they can have 2% of all the reserves into bullion. And they're going to buy in these sort of down periods. So as coming back to that thought process, as Robert Freeland said, that they are the biggest commodity hedge fund in the world. Whatever they want, get long. And whatever they have extra off, get out of the way because they're just going to dump it. And something they're not dumping is gold.
Some folks have referred to it as a gold singularity when the yellow metal crosses the threshold, disappears into the abyss, because there are some curbs on exports, just the opposite of India, where there are curbs on imports. And that's a good segue into another topic you raise, and that's India might just ease its gold import curbs. Please tell us more and how that might impact the markets.
You know, there's a great question, and another thought process is that if the government doesn't track the gold, it doesn't track it because they stopped selling it through the post office system, and they stopped selling it through some of the banking facilities and chains, and therefore they don't have to report it. They don't have to report it. Their current account deficit looks better. If they turn around and have to report it, and you start seeing all this gold demand coming in, then their current account deficit looks worse. They have a currency issue. So one of some of the thoughts out there is that the government has this policy is actually, it's a switch, try to impose these other variables, but gold still is still showing up in India. And so that, to me, is a real significant factor. I think that's also this bullish for the rest of the countries is from Austria to Australia. The gold refineries are booming in business. They're still having record gold coin sales. And I think that the G20's meeting and the G20 is not more about trade. You hear all these protesters, etc. They just don't get it. It's about tax collecting. It's synchronized global tax collection. And you don't see the trade ministers from the G20 getting together, but you do see the finance ministers getting together. And so as that becomes more restrictive, then you're seeing around the world that people are saying, you know what, I'd like to have a little gold. Because there was, Venezuela, that if you had a credit card issued from Venezuela and you did travel to the U.S., your credit card was only allowed to go to gas stations, they were able to decode it, and to buy food. You couldn't go and go to fancy places or buy clothes or other commodities, etc., like radios or televisions, etc. The credit card was prohibited from doing that, and that's basically for controlling your money. And that sort of becomes a sort of gold bug fear that they should start to own gold, and you're seeing gold coins rise. And I was commenting to someone the other day, and they were telling me, most interesting, they said, actually, the biggest shortage is bullets. There's rationing of bullets. There's not rationing of gold right now in the U.S. And so I really don't know that fear trade that comes out in the marketplace. But I do know that it's just prudent to have some gold jewelry for the one you love. It's very common in the rest of the world, to Asia, Middle East, etc., to give a gold coin for graduation from high school, a gold coin for any type of an anniversary, or gold jewelry, 22 or 24 carat jewelry. And that cultural affinity, I don't believe, is going to go away. But one of the things last year you did see for that gold love trade is that the GDP per capita actually went flat in India. And that, to me, is more significant because there's a high correlation of rising GDP capita in China and India that's led to the strong jewelry demand.
You also touch on the global gold supply, that this could be an issue, that perhaps we're just not seeing quite the output that folks are expecting, and there might be some delivery issues in the future. Any comments?
Yeah, I think there's so many delays and disappointments. It's so difficult to mine gold. Mother Nature has its challenges, and if you're in Latin America, you've got local community issues. You have governments that move the goalposts on a regular basis looking for tax revenue. You have the commodity risk, and then you have Mother Nature. They have, like in Colombia, they have illegal workers. Good first-class Canadian mining companies get blamed for destroying Mother Earth, but really it's illegal workers and mine workers that steal the gold, use cyanide, etc. So you have it so difficult to actually get supply on side. So a lot of companies have had massive delays and disappointments in delivering the gold that they said they were going to deliver. And there's lots of very compelling research that shows that whenever one company says that they have a major environmental problem, a security stock exchange complaint, where there's a tax change, property dispute in a foreign country or domestically, that stock falls for 50% for 18 months. Well, we've had so many companies have one issue like this after the other. That's another big reason for the massive decline last year in stocks, in addition to the price of gold going down.
You also talk a bit about real interest rates and how this can impact gold. And this is actually been a subject for a lot of discussion for several hundred years by economists. When we see those negative real interest rates, gold has a tendency to outperform other assets. What are your models showing you and telling you now?
Well, they showed you that the forward curve is anticipating rates, inflation to rise, and we'll see if it unfolds. The balance in gold is saying that the bottom in the CPI that took place in October, November, that's behind us. So I think it's very important for all your listeners to recognize it's not just America. It's any country where the government pays you less than the inflationary rate to hold treasury bills or their bonds, gold starts to become more valuable in that country's currency. And you can go all through Latin America, Africa, you can go to Asia, it doesn't really matter. That's a very important factor. So what we did have for a 12-year run is that gold, the sort of government in the U.S. had negative real interest rates, and that boded well for gold. Finally turned positive, gold took it on the chin. Looks like it's going to turn negative again this year, and gold is starting to find a bottom. We'll see how it unravels over the next 12 months.
Well, as we wrap up, is there anything else on your radar screen? Anything you'd like to share with listeners, topics we haven't covered?
I think it's important for shareholders to recognize that you have a 10% weight in gold stocks. And you rebalance that each year, because when you get these great runs of 120% a year, you take your profits and you buy the S&P. Or you buy good mutual funds. Our Holmes Mega Fund had a spectacular year last year. And if you have the bulk of your assets and your equity assets in the overall market, then you end up doing well over any running time period. Even the past 10 years, this rebalancing mechanism is just prudent. And I'm a big believer that you should buy gold jewelry. You should be able to try to buy it by the gram, so that you can turn around and share it with the loved ones in your life. And this gives a great feeling in your heart, because you're sort of marrying money with the honey.
I wonder if you could tell folks a bit more about the services you provide, as well as any other contact information you'd like to leave with the listeners.
Well, we are a public company. Ticker symbol NASDAQ is GROW, G-R-O-W. We have gold mutual funds, and we've received many Lipper awards for our performance in emerging markets and gold and resources. You can follow what we feel about the marketplace. Sign up for Investor Alert. You go to usfunds.com. You can get ultra-short government bond funds, tax-free ultra-short funds. You can buy big-cap growth funds, and you can buy gold funds and emerging markets and China funds. So we do all of that, and on a regular basis, what I think I'm very proud of, which we win awards for, is a weekly investor alert, which goes out to about 40,000 people in 170 countries. It's a SWOT analysis. What were the strengths and weaknesses of last week that affected gold or markets, any market, and then what could be the opportunity or threat next week? It's always succinct. It's always three sentences for three strengths, three weaknesses last week, and next week, what are three potential opportunities, and what are three potential threats for next week, and to try to have this balanced perspective on capital markets. So I welcome anyone to contact us at usfunds.com or phone 1-800-US-FUNDS and receive more information and sign up for our weekly investor alert.
Frank Holmes, thanks for sharing your wealth of information with us here today. We'll look forward to having you next time on GoldSeek.com Radio. Featured guest today manages $100 million worth of distressed properties. It's a pleasure to have Fabian Calvo in his debut appearance here on GoldSeek.com Radio. He runs thenotehouse.us. We'll have links up there. Welcome, Fabian Calvo.
Thanks so much for having me on, Chris. I appreciate it.
You know, I first became acquainted with your work on Greg Hunter's USA Watchdog program, your housing forecast. You say the U.S. real estate market is in recovery mode, but it is an illusion that most deals are cash transactions carried out by hedge funds and institutions with deep pockets Eventually, the public, though, is going to rush back into the market when zero-down payment loans, you know, become the rage, probably, you say, after the midterm elections. And that could be the death knell for this market as wealthy investors empty their portfolios, if you will, their overpriced McMansions and crumbling debt shacks.
What I've actually have termed this real estate house of cards pump and dump, if you will, and that's exactly what's going on, and already evidence is abundantly clear. As we well know, all markets right now in this type of environment are all manipulated, the housing market being the central manipulated market. To quote Bernanke, we need a housing recovery to basically fuel real economic growth and a real recovery. So that's what you're seeing happen right now is, you know, hedge funds, private equities that are getting billion-dollar line of credits from the top five big banks at, you know, less than 1%. And they're going and they're speculating, buying real estate in large pools of hundreds and hundreds of houses at a time. And then you also have the emergence of no money down loans. Just yesterday, there was a report that came out from Wells Fargo saying they're getting back into subprime loans to fuel the housing market that's starting to cool. So we're going to see, I think, after 2014, the ramping up of these no money down loans, and it's going to blow the market back up, similar to what you're seeing in the stock market right now.
Much of your work actually parallels that of Robert Shiller, co-creator of the Case-Shiller Index. I like to watch as a proxy for the real estate market the HGX Housing Index. I mean, we're seeing a recovery. One thing I really appreciate about your work is your contacts in the industry. I'd like for you to tell us where you made some of these contacts, why they are so knowledgeable, and how come what they know and we don't know could hurt us as individual investors and mortgage holders.
Yeah, well, absolutely. That's a great question. And, you know, it's starting my company, The Node House, and obviously, I mean, my company's small. In 2012, we closed a little over $100 million in the purchase of distressed debt and bank-owned properties. But, I mean, you know, I often go to these conventions where you have companies that are closing hundreds and hundreds, if not billions of dollars in distressed deals and in just large volume type purchases. So just really through networking and also through the financial updates and on the housing market that I do often, speak at conferences that are both private and public that deal with the real estate market, that deal with buying distressed debt, selling distressed debt. And I've been able to make a lot of different contacts in the industry that, you know, that like my view and my ability to kind of really simplify an explanation on what's happening with the Fed, with the manipulation and everything else. And, you know, a lot of these guys, I'll tell you, they believe, Chris, that this is, you know, basically, you know, they really buy into, and these are intelligent people, they buy into, yeah, this is a recovery. The Fed will be able to unwind the $4 trillion balance sheet that they've created in buying mortgage-backed securities and long-term U.S. debt that nobody else wants to buy. But you have a growing number that I'm seeing of real estate guys, of top financial guys, that are not only getting more and more diversified into gold and silver, but they all recognize that this is just another huge, huge bubble being created, likely will be much larger than the 2008 financial crash we saw, because as I believe, and as many of these other contacts I have believe, it's going to be a multi-bubble that blows up. It's going to be the stock market, the real estate market, the bond bubble, and likely a dollar bubble that implodes simultaneously.
When we start to talk about a bigger collapse in housing than we already saw, that's going to raise some eyebrows. We saw as much as Las Vegas, 89% at its trough. You know, we were looking at a nearly 90% loss in the typical home. Of course, that was an outlier, but it's still emblematic of a severe crisis we have here. So really what I'd like to do here is have you maybe go point by point, explain to folks, because when you start to talk about something bigger than 2008, the only thing that held up was the U.S. dollar and a handful of treasuries, T-bills, things of that nature.
Yeah, well, first off, let me just stress here for people listening that I honestly do believe that I think, and what I love about shows like these and you know, others that are out there is that the audience is an educated group of both investors and people that want to understand the way the economy works. And I think for that type of personality, these types of scenarios present a tremendous opportunity for the educated investor, for the educated entrepreneur that understands the business climate that we're in. But here's the thing. You know, when you have, let's say, the FHA with a $1 trillion-plus balance sheet of loans that were only required 3% down or less, and in many cases, that 3% is made up by either realtor commissions or the sellers, you know, chipping in some of the money, where in essence it's kind of like they're manipulating and almost committing mortgage fraud to basically sell a property. You have prices that continue to go up and up. I mean, you know, programs like Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, all they've done is made housing much more expensive for the average person to purchase. Scenario where the U.S. dollar, in my personal opinion, based on all the research that I've done, based on my contacts in the financial industry, when you have the dollar as the world reserve currency status, and the dollar does lose that world reserve currency status, as we have the IMF calling for, we have top Chinese officials calling for, we have the former chief economist of the World Bank calling for, among a litany of others, you're going to see a situation where people will not be able to finance home purchases. And so that will result in a tremendous collapse of housing prices across the board. And I'll tell you right now, Chris, I see this all the time, and I see this actually growing more so than I saw back in 2006 and 2007. These vulture funds that are beginning to shore up billions of dollars in capital to prepare for when this event does happen, they could swoop in as an opportunistic fund and buy real estate at literally pennies on the dollar. That's the type of environment that I think we're looking at. You know, I don't think this is going to happen in the next week or the next month. Personally, you know, I've been one of the kind of few people that, you know, is saying, look, I think the collapse is a few years out because I think the Fed still wants to create much more debt. I think they still can manipulate things a little bit longer. But I think 2 to 4 years, I think we see a monumental bust.
Will we see more John Paulsons profiting to the tune of $1 billion plus, purchasing credit default swaps and related instruments, benefiting on the downside?
No question about it. I mean, these guys play both sides of the market. As I said yesterday, I'm like, you know, people think that the money's made as markets rise. Actually, the real money for many of these guys are made when the markets crash. I mean, that's, you know, as the Rothschild said, it's when the blood's on the street is when you want to be buying, when you want to be getting involved in the markets. Now, to be crystal clear, Chris, the individuals that I'm talking about that I trust their financial outlook, and then based on all the research and my current experience being on the front lines of this market, you know, not all of these guys are these evil crony capitalists that crash the economy. Like myself, we recognize, it's kind of like, look, we buy gold and silver because we recognize they're devaluing the dollar. Does that make us bad? No. Does that make us, you know, taking advantage of the situation? No, it's just we recognize the times that we live in. And so, you know, anytime you have markets as heavily manipulated as they are now, where you just look at the historical precedent, you know it cannot last. You know the world reserve currency has changed 6 times before in the last 600 years. You know it'll change hands again because it doesn't last forever. These are situations where I think, you know, again, you prepare for it, you get ready for it, and if possible, you take opportunity of. Because ultimately, nothing you or I can do will stop these events. We can only raise awareness. We can only, you know, do what we can as individuals.
You can't stop a massive Category 5 hurricane, but you can certainly buy and put on a life preserver, can't you?
That's actually the best way I've ever heard.
We look at precious metals as financial life preservers, and we want as many folks as possible to be secure as the storm approaches. And I also wanted to ask you about this bond bubble and the dollar collapse. Now, you know, we've really heard a lot of folks, it's almost an echo on this show. It's really even cliche talking about dollar collapse. You know, I had Jim Rogers on last week, self-made billionaire. He's actually long the dollar because he believes that, of course, now this may just be a trade, but he thinks that these global emerging currencies are in a lot of trouble and people are going to turn to the U.S. dollar as a safe haven. What are your thoughts?
Hard to disagree with someone as successful as Jim Rogers and his track record. You know, I was having lunch yesterday with a business partner of mine. He's actually a Chinese investor from Beijing, and he was talking about how Chinese investors, with all of the problems going on in China, both politically and economically, even as China grows, and in my opinion, is becoming the new engine of growth, to quote George Soros, of the global economy, they're still really concerned, and so they still look at America as a safe haven. And I agree with Jim Rogers on, you know, on being long in the dollar. But ultimately, when you look at the $17 trillion in debt, when you look at the over $500 trillion in derivatives, when you look at over the $250 trillion in unfunded liabilities, it is a racket that can't continue. It's continued this long simply because we have the world reserve currency status and we have the Fed who can print trillions of dollars, not only to bail out U.S. financial institutions and keep the dollar propped up, but also bail out Western banks that also have a mass amount of dollars as their primary reserves, around 60%, although those reserves have gone down from close to 68% to now low 60s. So I think more and more, as the rest of the world catches on that the main export of the of America has now become inflation. You know, you have situations, for example, in China, where inflation's up 200% in the last 10 years in a population that is on the verge of revolution if food prices continue to rise. So I think these countries recognize, look, if we continue with this dollar-denominated system, we're going to have massive problems here. So we need to begin the process of detaching ourselves. You're seeing it already with the bilateral trade agreement. You're seeing it happen already take place with a lot of these central banks buying record amounts of gold. So look, will this happen, like I said, next year or in a couple of years? Likely not amid massive global crisis and failures of emerging market fiat currencies. But ultimately, I think there's a big bullseye on the U.S. dollar. It's a currency that I think we'll still use, you know, long term. It's just a question of what will it be worth and how much will it be devalued. You know, one more quick point I'll make, Chris, is that if we look at the Fed's target inflation of 2%, right, and we take that out 20 years, that means that $100 today will buy $150, or excuse me, the reverse. You know, we'd be looking at a third of a currency devaluation where, you know, where basically you have to now have $150 to pay for $100 worth of today, you know, a basket of goods in today's, in 2014, 20 years from now. So based on their approach and their numbers, we're looking at a third of a dollar devaluation in the next 20 years. That's if you believe inflation's running at 2%, and if you do, you also believe that you could keep your health care if you like it, you believe in weapons of mass destruction. Point is, we know inflation's running much higher. And so again, the question is it 20 years, is it 10 years, is it 5 years? Nobody knows, but my best guess, looking at historical precedent, is this current financial system cannot continue forever.
You may have read that Venezuela is having a lot of inflation trouble as well as currency issues. They're officially showing a 55% inflation rate, but what people are actually paying, 330%. If people don't think it can happen here, just go ask how much their groceries have gone up and how much lower their wages are relative to just 3, 4, 5, even 10 years ago. And you've mentioned in some of your work that you're calling for triple food and energy prices in the U.S. Tell folks more about that and what it would mean for investors.
The bottom line is that when you look at failed fiat currencies around the world, and you look at empires that have declined, whether it's the Habsburg Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the Roman Empire, the Soviet Union, they all have four characteristics to look for. They have a war. They have a war state that they've expanded drastically. They have rampant debt. They have absolute elite decadence, and they have rampant corruption. America hits on all four of those. And so, again, looking at history, looking at what's going on, the question becomes: you know, all of these countries where you've had, I believe, 56 or 57 that have ended in hyperinflation, they're all doing the same thing the U.S. is doing right now. Chris, I mean, it's the playbook that they've done in the past for countries that went into hyperinflation, or it's happening right now.
But Fabian, it's global in scale now, isn't it?
It's global. It's absolutely global in scale. And look, to really take this out a step further, you know, and this is where people begin to have varying different views. There is absolutely no question in my mind that this is a managed decline to push the world into a global governance, global financial system. And again, this isn't, you know, coming from bobsconspiracyblog.com. This is internal IMF documents. I mean, you can go right now and you can look at the IMF's own website talking about a super currency or a super global currency, talking about ditching the dollar. I mean, the handwriting's on the wall. Chris, you're talking about it all the time. So, again, you know, the question, and you don't hear this number in the mainstream media, but you hear it at the highest levels of the financial industry where they're openly talking about it. I mean, I've been in closed-door meetings where there's been Fed officials that are bragging about the quantitative easing. I mean, so, you know, this is a serious issue. And I want to just say, you know, again, the reason I love programs like these are because really it's like the Paul Revere of today. We're warning people of, look, it isn't necessarily doom and gloom. It's just reality. And the question is, what are you going to do to not only prepare, but to be able to have real self-reliance when, you know, when these events begin to really unfold and speed up?
Well, that is an excellent transition into my next question for you. You know, keeping with the impending economic collapse theme you've laid out here, you've got some solutions, and I'd like for you to talk about this. You suggest that Americans must escape what you've called the job paradigm, find novel ways to become self-employed. You know, with the true unemployment rate, the U6 figure, now in double-digit territory, this sounds like really good advice. Could you share your personal journey, though, beginning with, let's say, the 2008 housing decline, and then the ascent out of the ashes?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, look, in 2008, like many other investment firms and investors, I was, you know, impacted dramatically. Quite frankly, Chris, on the verge of bankruptcy, and I really did after really thinking about it, you know, talking with my wife, deciding what I wanted to do. I basically said, you know what, I'm going to recommit myself to the specialized knowledge that I spent 10 years prior learning and you know, spending time and money educating myself, which was real estate investing. And I saw that in the ashes of the collapse, that there was also tremendous opportunity. That's when I started my company, The Note House. 2012, we had a record year. Last year, we did even better. This year, we're looking to beat expectations for what we did in the last 2 years. And so the point is that I had two things that I think are important for anybody who wants to take either their career, their life, whatever it may be, to the next level, is that I set the bar high and I had a plan with a strategy to get there. And that's something that anyone within the sound of my voice can implement. Now, I'm a real big believer in either having some kind of specialized investment knowledge so that you can become financially independent, whether, I mean, I'm biased towards real estate investing because I'm a real estate investor. I help and I educate others in that field, but it could be stocks, it could be bonds, it could be gold and silver, it could be a bunch of different things, right? And at the same time, I believe that people must recognize that growing up, we've all heard this, Chris, I'm sure you've heard it as well, you know, go to school, get a good education, get a job, and hopefully you work at a place for, you know, 20, 30 years and get a pension. That paradigm has completely failed, and it's failing. I mean, the JOB paradigm just over broke is exactly what's happening with wages, not going up in the last 10 years, but as we've already talked about, food prices, the energy prices, everything else going up easily. I mean, 20, 30% in the last 20 years, and that's being conservative. So the way you stay ahead of inflation is, yeah, by owning gold and silver and having other hard assets. But I think it's also by being a business owner, preferably for me, some type of online business, because there's a high probability, and I see this almost every single day, that you could start an online business around what you love to do. You know, by 2020, there's going to be 7 billion people on the internet, the largest market. And let me tell you, just like history shows us, the rise and fall of world reserve currencies, it also shows us that during massive collapses, massive crisis, there's also tremendous opportunity. In the Great Depression, you had the most number of millionaires ever created. It's not even about becoming a millionaire. It's about becoming self-reliant and not being dependent on somebody else for your finances and being able to do it in a way where you can do it anywhere in the world. If you want to get out of the country and you run an online business, well, you're going to have to worry about, God, I'm not going to be able to go to my 9-to-5. So these are solutions and these are strategies above and beyond the basics, which, of course, are, you know, food storage, you know, having some cash on hand, having guns, all that stuff, which is critical, and I definitely think people should do. But we have to look more of a longer-term approach, more of a self-reliant approach, and I think these are all things that people really need to consider.
I wonder if you could talk some more about the dark period in American history here, you know, the Great Depression. You talk about, and you alluded to, the most self-made millionaires in American history during this time. And I think that listeners need to be aware that it's going to be important not just to survive this coming financial firestorm, but actually perhaps to profit from it.
You know, everybody, I'm sure, has played Monopoly. Well, Charles Darrow created Monopoly during the Great Depression. It was a parlor game that he literally blew up, and it's now we all know how successful it's become. But even back then, it was hugely successful. Kroger grocery stores was started during the Great Depression. Hewlett Packard was started during the Great Depression. J. Paul Getty, who, you know, obviously to his benefit, benefited from a $500,000 inheritance during the Great Depression, took that $500,000 and converted it into tens of millions of dollars. And really, the list just goes on and on. And so I think that, look, one of the things we see during collapses is really, here's what happens, is that we have competition. I don't really like to use the word competition, but nonetheless, we'll use it for purposes of this talk. competition really ceases to exist. A perfect example of that is in 2008 when the housing market collapsed, we had real estate agents in Florida went down by almost 70%, people that just stopped completely becoming a real estate agent. So for the 30% that stuck around, they were the ones that likely were able to make money and work with all the different investors that came in and started to buy. So it didn't just stop there, though. We also see that, you know, in the past, we've seen that during economic crisis, not only do we have people take advantage of the situation, we also have a massive amount of people that turn towards government and become even more dependent. So the bottom line is what categories you want to fall into. And so I think that people need to recognize, because, you know, one of the things, Chris, I think you and I would probably agree, you know, would probably we've both seen is that, unfortunately, many times in people that recognize times we're living in, they think that an economic collapse means pretty much the end of the world, doom and gloom and everything else. They need to know that, no, markets will continue, the world will continue, and what's your plan long term for living through that time?
Are there any low-budget surefire tips for passive income or maybe even online employment that are more appealing? For instance, maybe investing in distressed property debt. Any ideas?
That's a longer conversation, but I will add that with respect to real estate investing, it's the only asset class, and I know this is about to sound like a late-night infomercial, but I've proven this over 1,000 different times, is that real estate is the only asset class where somebody can monetize it with no money out of pocket. You can use somebody else's money or whatever. There's a variety of different strategies. So, people can research that. They can check it out. I have a whole entire course about it, resourcefulrealestateacademy.com. They can check out. But let me talk about online business, because this is a real passion of mine as well. And what I love so much about it, Chris, is that people can do it based off what they love to do. Anybody listening right now, all you need to do is look, what's your passion? What are you passionate about? What do you love to do? And then just find out if there's a market viability to it. Go on Amazon, go on Google. What are other products out there that are being created around what you love to do? I mean, it could be anything. It could be gardening. It could be, you know, cars. It could be technology. It could be, you know, gold and silver investing. I guarantee that in any niche out there, for someone's passion, there are other experts or people that are interviewing experts that are making a career, if not making a pretty good living, that are catering to that niche. And so what's the market viability of your passion? Finding out on Amazon and you know, looking for Facebook groups and looking for a community that's actively looking to, looking for more information. And then the second thing you want to do is you want to start, you know, a blog, video, YouTube, Vimeo, whatever it may be, sharing your passion and sharing information about your passion and building what I call a tribe, right? Building other people that like what you have to say, like your voice, or like your writing. And if you don't want to be that expert, then interview other experts in that particular niche, and people will want to see those interviews. And then from there, I mean, you could do all kinds of things, Chris. I mean, you could create different products, books, and services that, bottom line, add value to the marketplace, add value to the niche. And believe it or not, I mean, I have seen time after time after time people that have followed those exact steps that I've just given, and for under $200 can set up an online business online, an online storefront, and within a year or less replace their current income at a job working 9 to 5. I mean, it's incredible, and the opportunity exists. Like I said, by 2020, over 7 billion people on the internet, the largest marketplace the world has ever known. You know, what are you going to do? Are you going to tap into it? Are you going to share your passion? Or are you going to sit on the sidelines?
You have a very successful method of investing in the precious metals. It's basic, but I'd like for you to share it here as we start to wrap up our discussion today, because I think it could help many of our listeners.
I think you kind of touched on this, and I think you would agree. I don't necessarily look at precious metals as an investment. I look at it as an insurance policy to failing fiat currency. And I buy every month. So when prices were falling to $20, silver fell from 40 to 20 or from close to 50 to 20. You had a lot of people complaining because they bought at 40. Listen, I bought at 40. I bought at 45. I also bought at $8. The point is that I buy every single month. And over the long period, I know that ultimately in a world where an abundance of evidence exists to failing currencies, buying silver and gold every single month. And if you could, I mean, look, you could buy silver. You don't need to pay, you know, $1,300 an ounce. You can go to your pawn shop. You can buy small bits of gold. You can buy, you know, a couple of silver eagles a month, depending on what your budget is. I think it's, quite frankly, the best insurance policy towards everything we've talked about in this, you know, in this half hour, Chris.
Well, as we wrap up here, any topics that I haven't covered that you'd like to address today?
No, I think we've covered everything. You know, I just want to mention that, you know, last year, a gentleman by the name of Simon Black, listeners may know who he is, he had a convention in Santiago, Chile, where he invited several people, among them Ron Paul. Ron Paul, at the end of his talk, gave a really, really hit the nail on the head, which was, look, in the world where you have criminal governments running amok, the best thing you can do is become self-reliant. And, you know, I'm a big believer in becoming self-reliant across the board, and I think listeners really need to begin to come up with a plan, set the bar high, and figure out how are they going to become self-reliant as quickly as possible.
So I'd like for you to tell folks how they can find out more about you. They can get involved with your programs and any offers that you have, and any other contact information, please.
Yeah, so for all my video, my updated videos, they can go to stadiumforliberty.com. That's stadium, the number four, liberty.com. And they can also go to stadiumcalvo.me, and all my information and companies and everything else that I have going on are on those sites. And let me just say, Greg Hunter, of course, you know, like just like Gold Seek Radio and all these other great alternative media voices, I think are really leading to this new renaissance in America, but globally, for liberty, for free markets. And that's really what we need to focus on, Chris.
Fabian, we're going to look forward to having you back on the show.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me on.
My featured guest today is a true quant, you might even say a founding father in the field. Charles Nenner is the founder and CEO of Charles Nenner Research Center.
Hi.
Start off with a topic that's near and dear to you. What really drives these markets? You know, you say, forget the news. Really, investors do react to the news, and it's how they react that's important. And there is a way for every investor to get a leg up on the markets by following cycles. And I'd like to give you a chance to talk about this topic.
Well, let me take an example of IBM. Let's say IBM, you hold IBM, IBM is up 50%. And now IBM comes out with a great number. Now, the question is, does IBM go up or down? Well, if IBM goes up, then the Wall Street Journal will write IBM's results were great and people poured in and bought IBM. That is when the cycle is up, and gives a positive interpretation of the numbers. Now, if IBM comes out with the same great numbers and the cycle is down, IBM has to go down. So what do you write? Well, then you write things like, there was a lot of profit taking because investors don't think that IBM can do better next year. So you have the same numbers, but based on how the masses feel, which I know through my cycles, I know if they're going to interpret it as something positive or negative.
Now, I wonder if we could apply some of this cycle's work to the equities markets. 2013 was clearly the year of the stock of equities here, but you see some risk. You say, though, that this may not be the beginning of anything major, that the bear is still in hibernation. Maybe you could tell us a bit more of what cyclical work is telling you, starting with the equities market.
Well, we were out of the market at, what was it, I think S&P 1825 when the correction started. We didn't go short because it wasn't worthwhile. And now we'll go back to 1850, which is a major problem over there. And I think we're going to have a distribution going. We're going to hang around for a couple of months before we start a more serious correction. That could be based on all kinds of economic ideas. My idea is still that there is a risk of deflation, especially in Europe, and it will take the rest of the world with it. And investors will be in an investing climate that they're not familiar with. So I think 2013 did already look forward to the profits of 14 of this year. And the only way we can get a little bit higher prices is price earnings, the expansion, which according to my model we should have, but it should be minimal. So I think it's a broad top that is being formed before the market comes down.
You also suggest that this bond market rally we've seen over the past few decades could be getting a bit frothy. I wonder if you could tell people what you're seeing there, because many folks have bond funds as a core component in their portfolios.
Yeah, we, went out of the box, I think, 2 years ago, and then we went in because I said, who am I? But my models show weaker economy than the Fed does, so let's buy the bond in a cycle of the bottoming. So we're still long bonds and TLT. Interesting to know is now this is classical technical analysis that the bonds exactly today are against the 200-day moving average like they've been for the whole month of February. So we have to see if they'll go through. I don't see a lot of upside, but I don't see a lot of downside also because based on my work, soon the economy is not going to be as strong as everybody thinks.
And I wonder if we could move on then to the U.S. dollar. You've said that you expect some strength. From a technical perspective, the currency has been trading sideways for the last 3 years. Jim Rogers, self-made billionaire, told us on the show that he feels that many folks will be diverting funds away from some of these troubled emerging currencies. We've seen some chaos there in the markets, and that could bring some dollar strength. What are you seeing here?
Yeah, we're out of already a long time out of emerging markets, and I continue to say they look cheap, but they have a liquidity problem, especially if rates go up a little bit in the States, people are going to take out their money from the emerging markets, so don't try to bottom fish over there. It could give us some strength to the dollar, but later in the year, I see that the dollar will make a major long-term top. I think then everything will come together, and then we see that actually the United States is in not such a great shape as we think it is.
And I wonder if we could move on to the precious metals market. Your research center called the top there around 2011 following that near parabolic rise that began in 2010. I wonder what your cycles work is showing you here for gold and silver, please.
Yeah, I myself didn't do the gold and silver for the last couple of months, but I know that we're long, but we're long only for a trade so far. We have a very interesting cycle chart that people can get for free if they write to Charleston Research Center, and they ask for the quarterly. That's a quarterly gold chart. That means every bar is not a day, it's a quarter. And that goes back I think a couple of hundred years, and it shows the exact day of the high at $1,900. And it shows that in July is the major low in the gold market. Now, since this is a quarterly chart, so you can count 3 months backwards from July, so you have kind of a wide spectrum, so we're trying to fine-tune it. So we are long already, having in mind that the perfect thing would be the beginning of July for the resumption of the bull market.
You probably have some key levels that you are watching to sort of gauge whether or not this market is back on track to resume its bullish trend. Is there anything you're watching closely?
Well, for now, if we get there, we want to take profit just below 1,400. But you should know we have systems that give the dates and the level. So that's the level. Now, if it goes very slowly and it's getting close to July and around 1,400, then we probably will not go out. Just stay in. We just don't know July, let's say June, May. It should be, if this is the start of a new bull market, it's 2 months early. But what is 2 months on a quarterly chart of 200 years is not so much, but we like to be exact. So we're still being very careful and see this still as a short-term trade that has a maximum of 1,400.
Does any fundamental research enter into your work? Do you look at any particular metrics or economic numbers?
We look at all the economic numbers. So, for instance, we predicted the unemployment would go to 6.5%, and our cycle showed that by the end of the year, it turns around again, which means there's going to be higher unemployment by the end of the year. And we look at CPI, and we look at PPI, and it's just that we can look further in the future. We don't have to look from month to month. We know how many months unemployment is down or is up, and according to that, we can invest.
Are your algorithms, are they essentially locked in a dark box, if you will, and you sort of crank out predictions, or how much subjectivity is infused into your work?
Maybe 10%.
Are there any topics that I've failed to cover that you're watching closely that you think the listeners might be interested in?
Well, I just want to continue to say that commodity markets are in a bear market and for a while. Crude is a bit different because it has geopolitical reasons why it could go up. But corn and wheat and all those things, they copper, we're definitely looking still in a bear market for the commodities.
Then you'd say it's still a dollar story for the precious metals?
Yes. If you take everything into account, liquidity, safe haven, whatever you want, in the end, you always end up with a dollar. That actually is the equation with the silver and the gold market.
Well, Charles Nenner, we can't thank you enough for your time today. We'll look forward to having you back here on GoldSeek.com Radio.
Speak to you soon.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. This past weekend, I had the opportunity to connect with thought leaders from across North America at the Liberty Mastermind Symposium in Las Vegas. Perspectives ranged from gold suppression to economic collapse to Bitcoin to preparing for higher interest rates, a banking collapse, bail-ins, an intellectual revolution, and a spiritual awakening. As I listened to the speakers, I couldn't help but think how each person must take this journey on their own. Because at the end of the day, no one is coming to the rescue. For most of us, our family isn't coming to the rescue. For most of us, our friends are not coming to the rescue. And our government, sure as heck, is not coming to the rescue. One thing I gathered from talking with David Morgan, Greg Mannarino, Daryl Robert Schoon, Turd Ferguson, and many others, is that the inflection point is upon us. It could be as little as a few weeks or months or later this year. But it's coming fast. I thought the inflection point was going to be back in 2006 or 2007. The ability to extend and pretend on a global financial basis has been an astounding process to watch. It's been a painful 8 years since 2006, and there's more pain to go through from an economic, governmental, privacy, and freedom point of view. But that pain, that change, is not to be feared. It is to be embraced and prepared for. Because coming out the other side of the destruction that lies ahead of us is a rebirth, a redefining of how individuals relate to one another the world over. The totalitarian measures being implemented by governments the world over will not last. They are desperate measures attempting to hold on to an antiquated system of financial slavery that has imprisoned the world. We've been led to believe that what we're experiencing is change. Current-day political change is nothing but the hijacking of a larger concept of change that trumps politicians, trumps governments, and trumps the financial masters who would attempt to control the masses for another 100 years. There will be many casualties in the coming sea of change we will all have to endure. Those that come out the other side will be stronger, more resilient, and the creators of what will be a new frontier. Make no mistake, the old guard will put up a fight. Many will suffer, but the old guard has already lost. The caterpillar is spinning its cocoon. The butterflies that emerge will be you and me. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.